Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power. My guest, we are trying to reach him. We have a guest, the power of the poppy, harnessing nature's most dangerous plant ally, Kanaz Filan. We're trying to reach him right now, and as soon as we do, we'll be bringing him on air. Well, what I wanted to do was start off the show with a thought, and that's by Georgia Kelly. She made some comments that I thought were worth mentioning. She said, we've reached a cultural crisis, a breakdown of old forms that requires a different approach from the ones learned in the denominator system of social organization. It is important that we ask the relevant questions and not be too quick to rush in with solutions. Our minds have been trained to want answers even before we have fully explored the questions, and the pattern keeps us immersed in the old system. To be in a state of not knowing is uncomfortable. We feel vulnerable, exposed. But it is in this state of chaos, as in the real meaning of the word chaos, being emptiness pregnant with possibility, where new ideas and holistic visions can take root. Befriending chaos is one way to break old patterns and nurture the creative seed that can blossom into personal, social, and cultural transformation. My goodness, don't we all go through that? We all have situations in our life that create a momentum that many times we'll fight and we'll say, oh my goodness, why in the world do I even want to go? Because I feel so much safer where I've been. I know that space. I know that place. Even if it's been a place of misery, I know it. I know it well. So to step away from it means that you have to be open for different concepts, different paradigms, and that can be very frightening. I'll never forget watching a program, and this was a number of years ago, and there was a young man, when he was in college, he decided to do a paper and a project, this paper was written about, dealing with people that lived in Harlem in New York. And he had, I think, 20 people. One was a thief. There were a number of women that were interviewed, and at the time, they all of these various individuals, these 20 people, had been of an environment that was pretty hard. Now, all of them had the opportunity to go to school. Many of the young women said they wanted to go on to college, and they had dreams, they had aspirations. And he documented their environments at the time. There, as it was, I mentioned one individual who was the thief. 20 years later, he goes back. And he found almost every single one of the individuals that he had interviewed and filmed 20 years earlier. So out of curiosity, he wanted to find out what had happened to their lives. All of them, except one, were living in a world exactly what they had grown up in. The thief was still stealing. The young women that had wanted to break away had become so accustomed to the welfare system, they were still in it. One of those young women had even started to go to college. But she got stuck. Again, out of all of those people, out of 20 individuals, only one left the area and made a life for themselves as they had wanted to do from the time that they could remember. And he was really fascinated with this. In this study, he said, it really surprised me because every single one of these people had the opportunity to be able to expand their world and to be able to lead the environment that they had such disdain for and hated so much. But because they were comfortable, even in their misery, they stayed there. Now, this was just one example that I remember reading about and watching on a show so many years ago, and I thought it really is fascinating. It is not easy for us to be able to step away from what we know. And one of the things that I've observed with the many, many people I've interviewed on this show, and there's well over 2,000, well over 2,500 actually, in the 10 years that I've been doing this program, invariably, they all had to go against whatever was their environment to step up out and become better than what they had been in. And with every single one of them, there were challenges. Not all of them have become millionaires, no. Many of them lived very modest lives. Others became multi-millionaires. One person I'm aware of has become a billionaire. But the key is they were willing to dare to step out of the world that they had been brought up into. And if you look at what's going on around the world today, there is a lot of conflict and a lot of confusion because of that very component. And people have a very tough time letting go of sometimes what they call tradition or a cultural environment, even if it is extremely oppressive and painful. And it is something that all of us go through this experience on one level or another in our lives. And what we need to remember is that we do have the opportunity to make change. We do have the opportunity to move forward. We do have the opportunity of choice. But it is going to be up to us to make that choice. That's very, very important. It's up to us. So I just wanted to share that with you because I thought George's words were very, very powerful and very, very profound. Now we are trying to reach Kanaz. And hello.
Hello, Donna. I am so sorry for the delay. It's like we are having some problems, phone problems here. I am here. I am very sorry
Whoa,
for
you. Oh, wonderful. Kanaz is with us. Oh, I'm so glad. Kanaz, where are you located?
I am in New Jersey. I'm not like north central New Jersey.
Oh my goodness, were you affected by the heavy flooding?
We were very, very fortunate in that we live on a hill. I mean, we did get a little bit of water damage in one room, but a half a mile down the road from us, there were people whose basements were under 7 feet of water. So it's like it was very, very patchwork. I mean, people really underestimated the damage that Irene did because it wasn't, we focus so much on the wind, we forget how dangerous the flooding is.
Absolutely. Well, I'm so glad we were able to reach you. And I'll tell you, I have total empathy for you because I have had through the years people that lived in Pennsylvania. I remember when Pennsylvania was flooded so horribly where total houses were washed away. And
1972, Hurricane Agnes. I was 7 years old. I was in Pennsylvania then, so yes.
Oh, my goodness. So you have those situations. And then for those of you that are listening, my guest, Kanaz Filan, we've got him finally, and they're having problems in New Jersey, and I'm just so glad we were able to connect. And I really, really have nothing but tremendous appreciation for the wonderful spirit of the people back there that have gone through so much. Our country has been hit with such phenomenal weather fronts. And I just think the power of the individual has just been so absolutely awesome. Last year we had Tennessee that was underwater. Just so many storms coming through that have just absolutely been incredible. But we have you on the air right now. Kanaz, I was so impressed with this book. I have not ever seen a publication on the poppy that was so extensively researched, and it's so absolutely amazing to read. I mean, this must have taken you a lot of time to put all of this information together about this plant.
Well, the, the information was there. It's more like, I think one of the jobs of a writer is to look at, much like a sculptor looks at a big pile of rock and turns it into a statue. I mean, I think a nonfiction writer looks at an enormous pile of data and tries to turn it into a story. In the case of the poppy, it was easier than it seems because, like, there was so much fascinating information about it. You know, it was like one of the tricks, like, I always have to try to remind myself when I'm writing is, like, if I don't find this material interesting, nobody else is going to. And it's like when I was studying this stuff, you know, there was just so much interesting material about this. There's so many things to talk about, you know, from the history of the poppy, from the way it spread, you know, to the way we're fighting it today with the drug war, you know, to all of the things that it's given us. It's like, it's just such a powerful plant, and it's just so many enormous gifts, and yet there's such a tremendous ambivalence to it and so much danger. I mean, it was a fascinating subject, and it was a lot of fun for me to research, and, you know, I'm glad that you enjoyed reading it.
Well, I really did, and I would like to go into a bit of the history regarding the poppy, because we talk about the drug wars, which have not been successful at all, but the thing is that this has been around. We honestly don't know for how long, but the agricultural communities, you said, along the basin of the Danube River are one of the earliest recorded areas that we have information on at this time regarding the poppy. This is really interesting stuff. And how did it get to the Near East? I mean, it's all over the place.
It's all over the place. So far as we could tell, the poppy, the Papaver setigerum, the original wild beginning of Somniferum, begins around, like, it's seen on the southwestern Mediterranean, along the coastline there, along the France, Spain, that area. It spread, apparently. The only reason it could have spread, well, I can think of two. One of them being the poppy is one of the most potent antidiarrheals known to man. It will, Imodium AD, which people still use for diarrhea, is an opiate. People don't realize that. It's loperamide. Opiates are really good for shutting down diarrhea. And, of course, there's the other thing is if you take opiates, you can get high from them. I suspect both of those things had to do with it spreading. I mean, one of the current theories of agriculture, which I find, you know, to be fairly convincing, is that early agriculture was really labor-intensive. They weren't really doing it for... The way I've heard it described was they didn't start doing grain because they wanted food. They were growing grain because they wanted it to make drink, to ferment. Basically, we started growing grain because we could use it to make beer, and I think we started using poppies because we could use them at first to make poppy tea, and then people discovered the sap of the poppy, the latex it produces when it's injured, which we call opium, was strongly psychoactive.
Now, one of the components that you bring out about the history is that the poppies produced a number of things. One of them was oil that could be used for lamps. And you make a comment, of course, in your book, we're going to go into that too, about the shaman. But you said it in your book, and I quote, it was unlikely that the primitive farmers, because they worked so hard to get the poppies to grow well, that they weren't aware of the psychoactive properties.
Yes, because you can use poppy seed. I mean, anybody who's in, like, I'm in New Jersey, like, there's plenty of Jewish delis near me, you know, it's my family's Eastern European, I've had poppy seed rolls, I've had poppy seed cookies, you know, the poppy seeds are certainly edible, and they're a good protein source. Poppy seed oil can be used for lamps, but there are other things you can use that you can get more quickly, and again, I mean, I think it's disingenuous to assume, you know, given how much we as a current species enjoy altering our state of consciousness pleasurably, I think it's disingenuous or naive to assume that, like, this is a new phenomenon and that 10,000 years ago human beings didn't enjoy getting high just as much as humans enjoy getting high today.
Now, one of the other medicinal aspects, and again, the poppy has so much that's very positive about it. You talk about two different poppies. You talk about a corn poppy, and you said corn poppies don't contain morphine or generate opium, but their petals contain the alkaloid
roacine. Corn poppy, also the red poppy, that's the one you see in, like, in Flanders Field, the poppies grow beneath the headstones row by row. Those are corn poppies. Those poppies are, they don't have the morphine. That poppy, it is mildly sedative, and it has been used for a mild sedative. There's another poppy called a horned poppy, which is just a really interesting plant. I mean, this thing has, this gray, glaucous, really heavy, thick leaves. It's got this, flower that's not particularly attractive. It doesn't smell really good. But it's got something in it called glaucine that's also just about as good at stopping coughing as codeine. So, yeah, there's a number of poppies that have active alkaloids. The most important thing that morphine can do, I was talking about getting high, and it can alter your state of consciousness. The most important thing that opiates can do is they are just incredibly powerful painkillers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, in fact, pretty much even today, if you look at the pharmaceutical toolkit, with the exception, you have aspirin and acetaminophen and a few other mild analgesics, any really powerful analgesic you're using today, pretty much anything that's from codeine on up, everything you're using to make people feel to relieve pain is an opiate.
Mm-hmm.
So we still rely on the poppy for our painkillers. I mean, morphine is still the gold standard for pain relief.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why there's been such a challenge with addiction to medicines, pharmaceutical drugs. Because
Absolutely.
This is something that the body many times will adapt to what's being ingested, and they need more and more and more. And I've known a number of individuals that have had the real challenges weaning themselves off of their prescription medications for the very thing that you're discussing. Now, you bring out how the Greeks knew about the negative side of opium. You talk about Virgil talking about how important it was to be very leery of this. And Hippocrates was very concerned. So those that were involved in what we would call the medicinal arenas were very, very cautious with this. And they knew that there were dangers. And that was something that they were very open with. But Virgil made the comment that the poppy was very important to Italian economy and had specific growing information regarding the poppies, because they found that the poppies
were
in
poppy
roots,
fields in
depleted
Italy.
The soil.
Yeah, there were poppy fields in Italy. There were poppy fields, in Sumeria, Hulgil, the joy plant. Now, the thing with addiction, I do not want to minimize the danger of addiction to opiates. That is very real,
right,
as anybody who's ever gotten addicted to oxycodone or to morphine or heroin or any of those drugs knows. I would, however, point out that if anybody listening here is taking antidepressants, if you've been on Prozac for a few months, if you've been on Effexor for a few months, if you've been on any of these regularly prescribed mood-altering chemicals and you suddenly stop taking them, you will have symptoms which, my friends, are physical withdrawal from that drug. There
mm-hmm.
are other drugs out there which are addictive, which we still use because because we feel that the value outweighs the risk of the addiction. The main problem is psych, you can become addicted, but they're not recreational. You can become physically addicted, but they're not particularly recreational. What
mm-hmm.
the war on drugs is worried about is, people can use these because they're fun. And
mm-hmm.
that is a genuine concern, but I will say in the case of pain patients, it is one that is much, much exaggerated. Among pain patients, I'm trying to remember, I had some figures around, I want to say it's like less than 10% of all people who are prescribed pain pills for chronic pain. I mean, they will get physically addicted to the opiates. They will need to be, as you said, weaned off. Once they're weaned off, it's not like they're suddenly pawning their stereo to go buy heroin. It's like there is a difference between an addiction and a psychological dependence. The problem mm-hmm. with the war on drugs is, you know, we are treating, you know, we're trying, in the name of stopping crime, what winds up happening is a lot of times you've got people who are in genuine pain. You know, you're talking people with slipped discs who are being prescribed like Tylenol with codeine when they really need like a morphine or stronger strength painkiller because their doctors are afraid of going to jail as pill pushers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I think that's something which greatly concerns me is the fact that, you know, I understand that there are people out there who abuse drugs. It's if you take this drug away, I'm pretty sure that these people will find something else to abuse. There's going to be a certain number of people who are going to do stupid things with chemicals, no matter, like, you know, you take the stupid chemical they're using away, they'll find a new stupid chemical. We have
Absolutely.
To accept that, and we got to admit, you know, okay, there are people out there that are going to be drug addicts. We will deal with them. In the meantime, there are people who are in pain. These people are suffering. And we, you know, the medical profession is going to do, should do what it can to alleviate their suffering. If that means prescribing them large doses of opiates, then so be it. If that means that they're addicted to opiates, well, fine. They're addicted to opiates, but they're not in, you know, they're at manageable levels of physical pain.
One of the statements that you make in the book, which really was an eye-opener for me, you talk about how the poppy business eventually moved to Afghanistan, which is one of the world's biggest producers of opium for illicit heroin production. And you have history on the Muslim aspect and how the Muslims actually taxed poppies. I'm bouncing around here. But then you make this remark, and I'm going to quote it directly from your book. At least half the drugs leaving Afghanistan pass through the Islamic Republic of Iran. It floods the country with cheap opium and heroin. And after the 1979 revolution, Iran quickly eradicated the growing of opium poppies. Today, no opium is produced in Iran, but despite this, the country has the world's highest rate of addiction.
World's highest rate of heroin addiction. Estimates I've heard range from anywhere from 3% is the low to 10%. That means out of, like, you know, 100, like, you take 100 Iranians at random and, like, you know, at least three of them will be opium addicts or heroin addicts, maybe as high as 10. That doesn't even include the number who just use occasionally. It's a huge, huge problem within Iran. Iran has actually done, you know, they've had methadone maintenance programs. In some ways, their treatment of the drug war has been better, smarter than ours. It's one of the few things they've actually done, like, really, that I can look at, like, with the Islamic Republic of Iran is, you know, you did, they are giving out needles in prisons. You know, they're accepting. They have needle exchange programs. You know, there's many states in the United States where you will get arrested for giving addicts needles.
Mm-hmm.
So Iran, Iran handles their heroin problem better than Mississippi handles theirs.
You bring out information about a movie which I have seen, the American gangster Denzel Washington played the lead role in this movie. It is a powerful movie, and it was so close to the truth that it really raises the hair on the back of your neck. But you talk about Lumac heroin, and Lucas, who is the man that Denzel Washington portrayed in the movie, turned state's evidence, and it revealed how many people in the legal system were involved in his network, because he was a mafia of type, involved in that network.
That was the one where they were shipping in when they were bringing dead soldiers, where they were shipping them home from Vietnam. Somebody figured out that, well, you know, nobody's really going to look in these caskets, and that means we can put a few kilos of heroin in each casket. heroin. There's a lot of heroin in Vietnam. There's a lot of heroin in Burma. We financed a lot of the heroin trade was used to finance, like, we brought heroin into the United States and used it to finance operations in Laos. We used it to finance, like, a lot of our South Vietnamese allies. You know, basically everybody in that little corner of the world sooner or later is either dealing heroin or they're dealing with somebody who's dealing heroin. And we turned our back and looked the other way. The same way we turned our back and looked the other way after World War II, when the Corsican mob broke up a strike and stopped the communists from gaining a foothold in Marseille, France, we let them ship heroin to New York. That was the famous French Connection. I mean, there's the U.S. war on drugs has generally been a war on the people of color and the poor people of America, and a means by which black ops and other dirty gangs games have been financed, you know, through a black pool of money, which is funded by drugs. So, you know, that's, yeah, what that was also to me, I think, one of the things when I started looking into the drug war, like how dirty it really was, how many people, how many lives are being destroyed by it, and by the fact that my government is basically playing both ends against the middle here. I mean, it's not a coincidence that when we got involved with the Nicaraguan Contras in Central America, our production of crack cocaine flooded the streets.
This is something that when this kind of information comes to the forefront, it really, really is upsetting. But your book deals with this information, and you've got all kinds of details. And let's go to Russia. And you said in your book, Marxist-Leninism may have created a culture without hope. Its downfall produced a society that dared to hope only to be bitterly disappointed. And boy, can I relate to that, because I knew many people that were in the former Soviet Union. But I was not familiar with the term kompot, K-O-M-P-O-T.
Do-it-yourself heroin. You boil poppy straw, you throw some acetic anhydride in it, you use a couple other things, you turn it into cheap heroin, you filter it, and you shoot it into your veins. It's incredibly caustic. It'll kill you sooner or later. But, you know, it's not even as bad as a new one I found out about after this was released, where they're in Russia, they're now taking codeine tablets. They soak them in gasoline. They do a few other things involving iodine and stuff. They change the codeine into an opiate called desomorphine. They call it crocodile because it's like, and they then, because there's still pill sludge in this, a lot of times it would clog thin needles, so they'll take these monster needles, like the kind of needles you use when you're shooting steroids, the big ones you use for intramuscular injections, jam these into their vein and shoot this this desomorphine, gasoline, iodine, heavy metals, all kinds of stuff in there, like, in basically what you get is like body parts rotting and falling off. It's really horrifying, and it's like that has become an epidemic in Eastern Russia among the poor, like some of the poor people. There was one, I remember, they had a guy had, if you've ever heard of Fossey Jaw, he had lost all his veins, so he started shooting into the femoral artery in his neck. The phosphorus they were using from the matches to make this stuff ate holes in his, he had Fossey Jaw, which is basically his jaw melted and started leaking out through open sores. It was horrible.
This, you know, I really wonder if maybe some of this stuff shouldn't be put on film and shown to young people. Now, maybe it wouldn't make any difference for some, but to actually be able, and even adults, because there's a lot of stupid adults out there, but this is something, and you go into such clarity in your book with this information on the power of the poppy. It's just absolutely amazing. You go into OxyContin, which I've heard it, but I had no idea how toxic this was and how people have been using it, and that eventually there was it was a big deal because Purdue, the company that put it out, they were penalized, but they're still pumping this stuff out there where people can get to it, and it's deadly stuff.
Well, the thing with OxyContin, when it got started, it got big, like the joke about hillbilly heroin and redneck heroin. a lot of hillbillies and rednecks, you know, and I say this growing up in a very rural area. I grew up in an area of northern Pennsylvania that was so rural, our zip code was EIEIO. I mean, I grew up in this country. People work hard there. People get injuries. You know, you have people there who are like, you know, throw their backs out. You know, it's, well, I can give up the farm, or if I can keep it a few more years till my son can take over for me. And the OxyContin could take enough of that pain away that they could keep working. So, I mean, for these people, it was a tremendous blessing. But it then got loose into the pot. Like, you know, then people started abusing it, and people started dying from it. Because, you know, again, you can't really fix that. Purdue tried to sell OxyContin as it... Oxy, like, you know, this is a time release. It cannot be abused. Unfortunately, the way you could abuse it is by crushing it. And people figured that out very quickly. One of the other things that just really amazed me when I did this book, you can have, like, fifth grade, you can have Beavis and Butthead sitting around here, you know, you know, absolutely not five brain cells to rub together between them. To find a way to get high, they will master college organic chemistry. It is amazing the stuff that people can. I mean, the whole process, though, not even opiates, like the whole process of cooking meth. You've got people who are making methamphetamine in motel rooms at like eighth grade educations. Which gets into one of the other problems of the drug war. If somebody really wants to get high, then like there is not a force in the world that's going to stop that person from doing it.
Well, I'll tell you, your book is an amazing read. And I really would recommend it highly to anyone that would like to become educated on the multiple levels of this, going beyond what we are fed by, I would call it propaganda and the mediocrity of media relative to really discussing the truth of this. And there is the good side and there's the bad side. And you need to be able to look at all of it, but you'll find out about Elizabeth Barrett Browning. You'll find out about Eugene O'Neill, Nelson Algren, Charlie Parker, William Burroughs, and so much more. It is an amazing book. Now, Kanaz, do you have a website that people can go to if they'd like to have more information?
I've got KanazFilan, KenazFilan. blogspot.com. I also do KenazFilan, KenazFilan, blogspot.com.
Well, I'll tell you what. You have just produced a product here of publication that I think has so much to offer to people, not just history, but to educate them, to make them aware of really a truth that needs to be looked at. And the facts and the points of information that you bring out here are just absolutely, in my mind's view, mind-boggling. So, Kanaz Filan, I'm so glad we were able to connect. I'm glad you're doing well in New Jersey, and I hope your neighbors are going to be able to work their way through this terrible flooding that they've gone through. But this was so good that we were able to connect today, because your book, The Power of the Poppy, is really awesome.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. It was a pleasure being on, Donna. You know, thank you for having me. I'm glad we were able to get connected, and I look forward to being on again soon.
All right, Kanaz. You take care now. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. And for those of you who have been listening to the interview, and again, I'm so glad that we were able to connect with Kanaz. It's, I believe, important to be educated. I think it is important that we not look at something and say, oh, well, that's terrible, and then turn away. When you can be aware of history, when you can be aware of the powers that be that use something for economic gain, regardless of the price that it brings upon the lifestyles of those that are brought into an environment, it is so important that we be awake and that we be consciously alert to the fact that there's much more that goes on behind the scenes than what we are typically able to see and that people like to let us know about. And when I think of this, when I first got this publication, I was reflecting on how the English had brought opium into China and how the Chinese government went through such a challenge. And I don't know that they still do to the same degree today, but I'm sure that there's still the problem. But it was really a serious, serious issue. So you have these things that go on throughout history. And when you can go back and you can look at it, and you can look at it with clear eyes and eyes that are open, not eyes that have rose-colored glasses on, you realize that there is a lot more to privilege and power than what you would have imagined. So it is a good thing to be alert and aware of, and it's a good thing to be educated about so that you can speak intelligently to young people and even some adults that need to be aware that there are going to be consequences. So, again, The Power of the Poppy was just an outstandingly well-done publication, and, again, I recommend it highly. Well, if you'd like to give me a call, the telephone number to call into is 888-627-6008, and I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. And all I need from you is your first name or initial. Just give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. And I want to let those of you who are in California know that I am going to be down in Southern California. I'm going to be doing a radio program in Santa Barbara, and I've got three areas of appearance. I'm going to be in Santa Barbara, Santa Ana, and also the Glendale, Burbank, Los Angeles area. So if you are listening and you'd like to be able to meet with me in person for a private consultation, call my office at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604. And I am available by phone as well as in person. So either way works for me. And also, I will be continuing to do the show. Other than the days that I am going to be flying, I will be available for the shows, and you will have all of that information listed up on my website, and that website is DelphiInternational.com. Well, I have a story for you that is a little bit of a mystery. It's about a man by the name of Andrew Carnegie. Aha, you're going to recognize Carnegie, of course. But this was his 28-year-old nephew. Now, Andrew Carnegie in his day was a billionaire. Well, on April 17, 1938, in New York, Andrew Carnegie Whitfield so again, was the 28-year-old nephew of the billionaire Andrew Carnegie. He checked into a hotel. Now, he used an alias of Albert C. White. Shortly after he had checked into the hotel, he decided he was going to go fly his plane. He had a silver and red Taylor Cub airplane. And he decided he was going to fly for a 15-minute, 22-mile flight. And after that, took off. He was never seen again. He had 200 hours of airtime, just 50 hours short of what he needed to qualify for his commercial license. He had enough fuel on the plane for 150 miles, and he was flying through a heavily populated area. Now, they knew when he took off, but 15 minutes, he never showed up. They never found him. A massive coastal search was carried out, and they were concerned that maybe it had to make an emergency landing. They never found him or the plane. Now, what was interesting about this event is that he had paid $4. Now, we have to remember, in 1938, it was much different money-wise. He paid $4 in advance for a hotel room, his personal belongings, his passport, his clothing, cufflinks that were engraved with his initials, stocks, bonds, and $12,000 in insurance policies naming his wife, Elizabeth, as beneficiary, were in the hotel room. Nothing was disturbed. Now, apparently, phone records showed that someone had called the Whitfield family home from the hotel after he had been declared missing. What further added to the mystery is that Andrew Carnegie Whitfield had been planning to move to Pennsylvania along with his wife at the end of the month. Well, his wife was very upset over this. She sued her absent husband, but declared the lawsuit was just a ploy to publicize his disappearance. They thought it might have been suicide. But nothing was adding up. Nothing made sense. He was a Princeton graduate, was having a wonderful career as a business executive, and nobody knew of any particular problems. You know what? They never did find him. Never knew what happened to him. Now, people would call in to the authorities and would say, well, we saw him do here, or we saw him there, but nobody ever found him again. Fascinating story. Vanished into the wild blue yonder? Who knows? One day, maybe the mystery will be solved. But so far, no such luck. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. 888-627-6008. You know, if you're like me, you can get so busy. You can have so much on your to-do list, and you may forget to prioritize. Has that ever happened to you? Holy Moses, it happens to me frequently. And I will just say, oh, I've got to do this. Next thing I know, my list is just so long. And it's not easy to stay, what I would say, focused sometimes, because maybe you have kids, maybe you've got clients, maybe you're doing different jobs for different people, and before you know it, your day's gone, and you go and you look at your to-do list and you go, well, I got one thing done, but you were so busy. The day just went by. Well, here are some suggestions that I came across that I thought was, that they're pretty good, they're pretty down to earth. One of the things is, according to Julie Morgenstern, we need to remember we can't get everything done. And many times having that list made out is really good. She said, if you sit down for 5 to 10 minutes before you start your work day, or even the night before, to plan what needs to be done and when, put your to-do list there and assign times to various tasks throughout the day to keep yourself moving forward. And she likes to use a timer. I've found that to be very helpful sometimes, not always. She said a deadline is a great motivator and a mighty aid in avoiding the mother of all distractions, the Internet. Do you have time eaten up by being on the Internet? Just with emails alone, I don't have to do anything else. I can down 2 or 3 hours a day. What about you? Well, I can empathize with you. One of the things she says is turn off your phone and shut down email when you're dealing with tasks that require focus. And that is very, very important, and that does make a difference. And when someone comes to you with something that can wait, she said, don't drop everything and go do that. Let it wait. I think that's a discipline that's so very important to learn to use. And don't be afraid to say to someone, I'll have to get back to you later. Better yet, put it on them to come back to you. And many times you'll find that you have to say to someone, I'm in the midst of a project right now. I'm not going to be able to speak with you. Call me back or stop by the office. Do it at this time. Check with me then. I cannot stop what I'm doing. You know, imagine if you were a surgeon in the middle of performing surgery and someone wanted to talk to you about your IRS form. I'm sorry, that's inappropriate. It's not going to work. So that's a silly example, I know, but I think you get the picture. And she said, also, don't avoid delegating around your home or your office because it's very important, and especially in the home, if you're a working parent and you've got kids, everybody should share in responsibilities. Women are terrible. I know. I'll raise my hand to this. We will just say, I'll do it myself. It's much quicker for me to do it. Well, again, you get sidetracked. And sometimes you need to make it okay not to do certain things. I know one lady who's very successful, and she told her family, I hate doing dishes, and if no one's going to take over the responsibility of washing them, well, none of us like to do it, so we're going to use paper plates. They don't use dishes. They use paper plates. I mean, this is what one family did. I'm not saying that's what you have to do, but be innovative. And she said, chunk it. Instead of writing clean the attic on your to-do list, break down the task into bite-sized jobs because you'll get things done more quickly. And I think that that is, you know, that's a reality. And, of course, you always have to be aware that you're going to have some unexpected surprises. And remember, you got to stay flexible because life is not a straight line. I haven't found one day yet that runs that way perfectly. Donna Sebo here. We're going to take a break for a moment. When we come back, I'll have some more good things to share with you. And if you want me to share my intuitive skills with you, call 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com. to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Do you have a sweet tooth? Well, if you're like me, sometimes you want something sweet so badly, and you go, what can I have that's not going to be packed with calories? Well, I came across a recipe called a no-bake orange cheesecake, and it's reasonable in calories, and with a cup of tea or coffee or even a good glass of milk, who cares? It's something that could satisfy the sweet tooth. So get the pad of paper handy and a pen, and I'll share that recipe with you. Tomorrow, we're going to have John Mazzarazzo, who is a wonderful musician. His music, Logical Drift, we're going to be sharing with you tomorrow. Wednesday's going to be an open mic day. This is a day where I decided I was going to leave the mic open for the entire hour, and I'll just have all kinds of odds and ends, points of information to share with you. And then on Thursday, we're going to be talking with Karen Calabrese. Her book is titled Soak Your Nuts, Cleansing. Now, this book is just fabulous. This gal is a doll. But it's about using foods to maintain, well, you know, health. And then on Friday, one of my favorite people, Jonathan Goldman, who is one of the finest experts in the world regarding sounds and using them for healing, wellness, using them for meditation. And we're going to be playing some of the excerpts from his chakra frequencies. It's fascinating stuff. Jonathan has been on the air with me before, and he is so knowledgeable about this. He studied with Tibetan masters, and he has this phenomenal deep voice where he can go into those tonalities. If you've ever listened to the Tibetan monks and their particular chanting, they have this vocal intonation that's so deep and so vibrant. It's amazing, and it's a certain kind of process of using the vocal cords. It's just fabulous. So we're going to be talking with him on Friday. We've got such a wonderful lineup of guests, and all you have to do is go in and check show information under the Donna Sebo Show listing, and you'll find out about all of the wonderful people. Then I wanted to quickly, well, let me go to the recipe first, because I've got something that was sent to me via email from one of you, and I really appreciate it. And thank you so much. If you have articles or you have special stories that you think I might be able to use on the air, or that you'd like to share with me about special people, et cetera, send them along to Donna@DelphiInternational.com, and I'll be glad to review them. I get a lot of material, but I will look at it, and if we can, I'll have it on the air. Here's the no-bake orange cheesecake recipe. Now, a cheesecake. Are you like me? Do you just really enjoy good cheesecake? Well, one of those tiny little slivers, and I'm talking about a sliver of cheesecake, can be 500 calories or more. So you have to think twice if you are trying to watch that waistline of yours. Well, how about a cheesecake? It might only be 282 calories a slice. Well, let me share with you how it's done. You're going to need 20 ginger snap cookies, 1 tablespoon of sugar, 1 tablespoon of sugar, 1 tablespoon of melted butter, 1 tablespoon of melted butter. You're going to need 6 to 7 orange slices, and you want them halved. And you want 1 envelope of unflavored gelatin, 1 frozen orange juice concentrate, and this has to be thawed at room temperature, and that's a small can. It's a 6-ounce can. You need 3 packages, 8 ounces each, of 1/3 less fat cream cheese. Now, again, all of these ingredients have to be at room temperature. And then you need, and that's 3 packages, 8 ounces each, of 1/3 less fat cream cheese, and then 1 can, 14 ounces of fat-free sweetened condensed milk, 1 tablespoon of grated orange zest, 1 tablespoon of grated orange zest, 1 container, 8 ounce, of thawed frozen light whipped topping. And if you want, you can have some additional orange slices that you could use as decoration. Now, this is how simple it is. You need an 8-inch springform pan. You spray that with your cooking spray. In your food processor, process your ginger snaps and sugar until they get nice and crumbly. Stir in the butter and a tablespoon of water, and then you press it into the bottom of the pan, just into the bottom, nothing up the sides. You take your orange slice halves, put them against the side of the pan, inside of the pan, and in a small microwavable bowl, you want to take your gelatin, sprinkle it over the orange juice concentrate, let it stand for about 5 minutes because it needs to soften, and then microwave it in 10-second intervals, and you stir after each 10 seconds of heat until it's nice and smooth. Now, on medium-high speed, you beat your cream cheese and condensed milk until it's nice and fluffy, and then gradually beat in the cool gelatin mixture. Fold in your zest and your topping and spread it over the crust. And you cover it. Just take a piece of wax paper or a saran wrap. Chill it for at least six hours. When you're ready to serve, run a knife around the top edge of the pan and remove sides. And then you can use some fresh orange slices, maybe a little bit of additional whipped topping to decorate it with. Good, light, and satisfying. My goodness, we're almost out of time. This is Donna Sebo. I want to say, remember, always you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Take care. God bless. Have a magnificent day. And we'll be back here, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Donna Sebo here. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.